Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, partner at VS Strategies. And with us in spirit is my policy partner in crime, Andrew Livingston, director of economics and research at Vicente Cederberg. With us today, we have a very special guest. We have a unique guest in the history of the weed wonks. Normally, we try to highlight as many of the cannabis policy nerds that we can, but we have a different kind of nerd. As Andrew Livingston likes to say, I am not that kind of nerd. And we certainly have a different kind of nerd here on the show today. We have a full-on legitimate scientist. I'm very excited to welcome our guest, Ben Catchman, Vice President of Research and Development at Pathogen DX, and most critically, a actual scientist who understands science stuff, not policy people pretending to know just enough to write laws and regulations, because Ben actually has a PhD in molecular and cellular biology, which probably means he knows more about nasty little bugs that grow in your cannabis than I certainly do. I can talk the talk, but we got someone who can walk the walk, and we're very excited to dive into kind of the nerdiest details possible in cannabis policy, which is the yucky organisms that grow in your weed that will make you sick. And so with that weird introduction, welcome to the Weed Wonks, Ben.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Looking forward.
So since you're a first-time guest and we want to get into microbials and testing and things of that nature, why don't you give us a little sense of your background and how you came to work in the cannabis industry?
Sure, yeah. So I have a undergraduate degree in microbiology from Indiana University and spent most of my time researching different microorganisms as well as viruses. And then I ended up getting a PhD in molecular and cellular biology, mainly developing diagnostic assays for cancer research, drug discovery, and drug repurposing assays. Kind of had a windy road to get to Pathogen DX, but I ended up here about 2.5 years ago, came on as a scientist. We had about 10 people here at the time, and started working on their DNA microarrays. Specifically, we were in the cannabis industry at that point, and since then we've branched out into food and healthcare as well. But I came on board to help develop the assays, help to build the platform, and take our assays through AOAC validation. So that's kind of where we're at now is, you know, I'm heavily involved in assay development, but also in the AOAC CASP program, and then work with Jordan sometimes on, you know, figuring out policy in different states.
Yeah, and I certainly appreciate that because I know just enough to be dangerous and maybe a little more from time to time. And so since some of our listeners may even be less in the weeds on some of this policy than I am, I'm going to give you two questions that I think will probably help at least all of our listeners who aren't in the testing side of the business have an understanding and maybe curious. And the first of all is, what is an assay and what is AOAC is the second one.
Okay. Those are two questions I get a lot. So I should probably define them better. So an assay is anything that you're being tested for. So you can think about it in terms of like a diabetic assay, right? So if you're diabetic, you're going to be taking a test, a finger stick or something like that to determine what your glucose levels are. It's the same case when you're looking at microbes. You are taking a sample of your weed, of your edible, of your tinctures, and you're looking for these different pathogenic microorganisms like E. coli and Salmonella and Aspergillus, which we'll get into a little bit later.
Okay. And so almost like taking us out of cannabis, I like the general medical example. If I were to like do a finger prick to check my glucose level, an assay is the like thingy I use to do the test, right? Okay, so you create the thingies that tell us the answer to the test. We say test for microbials, and you create the thingy that says this does or doesn't have microbials.
Yep, correct. Yeah, we're okay. Just creating the actual, you know, diagnostic platform that you use to say this is present, this is not present, you know, safe to smoke, not safe to smoke.
Yeah. I think when I started doing this kind of policy is when I learned the term assay was a thing. I don't know if everybody outside the testing sphere even knows what that is. They just want to know their stuff is safe. So it's critical to have good assays, but it's also critical to have approved assays. And so now let's get into AOAC.
Yeah. So AOAC, within the food industry, there isn't really a regulatory body that validates the different diagnostic assays that different companies produce. AOAC is a governing body. They're not really regulated through the government. They're a third party that allows test makers to take their diagnostic tests and validate them through a third party for different pathogens and then also different matrices. They're more heavy on the chemistry side, and they're very heavily involved in food safety. And as of the past 2 years, they started a program called CASP, which actually looks at cannabis regulations. And so there's a microbial side to that, and then there's a more of like a chemical side to it. So that'd be regulating, you know, testing around THC or other pesticides. And then more importantly to me, testing around E. coli, Salmonella, Aspergillus, you know, total yeast and mold, common microbial pathogens that are tested in different states that have legalized cannabis.
So AOAC and AOAC accreditation is really what lets us know whether you have a good assay or a bad assay, right? Is going to yield replicable results? Because the goal here is that a testing lab should be able to use whatever company they so choose to purchase testing equipment from and methodologies. But whatever they choose from a business perspective, those results need to be consistent, whether they use company A or company B. And theoretically, if both are AOAC accredited, then the results should be consistent and replicable.
Yep, correct. Yeah. So you can think of AOAC as a smaller version of the FDA, right? So when you're at a hospital and you're taking a test or you're sending your stuff to get tested, all of those tests have to be approved through the FDA, usually through a third party that's testing and making sure that the claim that I'm making as a test maker isn't bullshit, you know, making sure that it's all a legitimate claim. And that's what AOAC does. You know, we send all of our materials to a third party that does everything per the protocol. So they follow our protocol, takes it through a third party testing. And then that third party is saying, okay, it's performing as the company says it performs and stands up to the standards that we've set within the industry.
Okay. And so I think I'm probably just going to stop making assay jokes and silly references. And we could move on. I just thought you started explaining all of that. And I was like, man, if I hadn't been working on cannabis testing policy for the last 8 years, I might not have known what some of those things meant. And so figured let's dive into that. But that's kind of the primer, if you will, the prerequisite for what we really want to talk about today, which first is really like, you know, it's good that cannabis is tested in the regulated market. But I think that beyond the fact that it is good because it is tested, because then we know it's safe, or at least theoretically safe. I think there's a lot of folks that kind of, you know, haven't gotten down into the depths of the weeds of what that really means. What are we testing for? Why are we testing for it? At what phases are we testing for some different things? We're obviously not going to cite, you know, chapter and verse from different regulations around the country, but try to drive home some concerns about what are we really looking for? Why does that stuff matter? We've heard a lot from growers over the years, oh, well, we shouldn't be testing for this or we shouldn't be testing for that. And, you know, it's like, well, I mean, I guess like, you know, you guys are literally arguing that we should have moldy or weed out there half the time. And like, I don't know that that's something as a consumer I'm looking for. So we want to talk about those things. And then we want to kind of bring it into what does this mean from a modernization standpoint as the industry grows to evolve, you know, what are we going to start seeing as the next phase in the future? But why don't we start with today? And so let's start where it all starts, right? Everything in this industry starts with a farmer. It starts with agriculture, people putting a plant in the ground. And then at the end of the day, someone's going to consume that. And what we want to do is make sure that's safe. So what are the kinds of things that we need to be concerned about when we talk about raw flower? We talk about growing cannabis flower. And in turn, what are the kinds of things that we need from a product safety and testing standpoint to be mindful of?
Yeah. So everything really starts with flower. And from flower, you know, you're going to get all of your different products that are out there. You know, right now in the industry, we're kind of at this tipping point, right? So we have, I don't know, something around 33 states that have legalized cannabis in some form right now. The challenge is that every state has different microbial regulations for the most part. So the states are having a hard time agreeing on what it actually should be tested for. But in general, most states have testing for different pathogenic microorganisms. Almost every state has testing for E. coli and Salmonella. And then almost all states have testing for some type of fungus, whether that be total yeast and mold or Aspergillus specifically. So getting back to flower, you know, as that matrix exists, cannabis flower tends to have a high level of different fungal organisms that are present on it. A lot of these aren't pathogenic. They don't have any, you know, harmful characteristics to a person, but there are a number of organisms like within the Aspergillus family that can cause aspergillosis and cause some pretty serious respiratory infections. And if you think about the market, you know, the user market within the cannabis industry, you have a lot of people that are using cannabis that might be immunocompromised. So let's just think about, you know, the classic case of a cancer patient who's undergoing chemotherapy and wants to have a safe product to help with pain, to help with appetite. They're gonna want to smoke flower, and it's very important for that group of people that they have a safe product, because me and you, who are healthy individuals, we might not have an issue with Aspergillus. You know, we might have a little cough and then it goes away, but these people could develop a serious respiratory infection. And that's, so that's kind of the major use case for wanting to test and make sure that your cannabis is safe. You know, nothing's 100%, but if you're testing, hopefully you're able to identify products that are heavily contaminated. And on the other side, you have healthy individuals like us that might be smoking something. If it has a really high level of total yeast and mold, so that could be any type of fungal organism that's present in the flower. If you have a product that has a really high level of that, of all those organisms, that's what leads to, you know, asthma and different infections that might cause healthy individuals over the lifetime of them smoking these products to have issues. And one thing we've seen, we're in a number of different testing labs that handle, you know, high volumes of cannabis flower over the years. And what we found in a number of facilities is that these flowers that have these high levels of fungal organisms present, as they're breaking them up to do the testing, you're releasing these fungal organisms into the air. And it's actually getting into the air supply in these facilities. And we're seeing that a lot of these workers, you know, these people at the facility that are testing the cannabis for THC content for different microbial pathogens, they're ending up getting asthma infections. And when they go and monitor those facilities, they're finding these high levels of total yeast and mold. So it does have, you know, medical implications, you know, for people that are smoking it or handling it, that you want to produce a safe product.
Yeah. And there is just so much in what you just shared that I want to start unpacking, because it deals with patient safety, general consumer safety, employee safety. And so I think the highest level of order that you talked about is you paired Aspergillus, which is a particular type of bug. I guess I just need to say, like, when you talk about like high levels of fungal like loads in cannabis, like this is just so gross. And this whole thing is kind of gnarly. And like, I'm looking forward to a day where we kind of see some better both cultivation, but also really post-harvest practices to kind of decontaminate and treat cannabis the same way we would with, you know, milk and other things that we consume that are pasteurized and cleaned. But until we get to that day, we are dealing with a plant that has a quote unquote high fungal count, which I just think is a really fancy way of saying gross. And the biggest thing that we're concerned about, or maybe of the things, there are certain specific bugs, there are funguses that are growing on these plants. And one of those examples is Aspergillus. And we are trying to test to see if there is Aspergillus on it, because that particular bug causes serious lung infections in sick people. Or that particular, sorry, it's a fungus, I guess, not a bug. We're going to get to bugs. You just wait.
You can call them all bugs if you want to. Yeah, they're all some sort of type of bug that's out there. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of Aspergillus, almost every state has regulations around measuring total yeast and mold. We can take two prominent states and look at their regulations and kind of differences between those. We have California and Colorado are two good states to look at because they both look at E. coli and Salmonella. So that's something common. But then they take different approaches to looking at specific pathogenic organisms versus what we call broad class indicators, which is the total yeast and mold. So it's kind of encompassing everything. California measures four specific Aspergillus organisms, Aspergillus niger, flavus, fumigatus, and Torreus. And those are known to be highly pathogenic organisms, whereas Colorado is looking at a specific microbial load. And they're looking at basically in its entirety, how much total yeast and mold is present on the plant. So it's two different ways of looking at it, you know, and they kind of stem from what was available when the cannabis industry started off in terms of being able to test for specific organisms versus broad organisms. And so that kind of gets into a lot of details with the, you know, basically how the microbial diagnostic industry has evolved.
Yeah. And so what we see is kind of, I mean, what I've seen, and we've had some really interesting conversations with public health folks, is first of all, Aspergillus, and I think there are probably some other species that we could be looking at theoretically beyond just those and beyond Salmonella and E. coli. But there are specific species of fungus that frequently can be found growing on cannabis that would be particularly dangerous for human beings to consume, and at an extreme end, incredibly dangerous for immunocompromised patients. Secondly, and I think this is something that you talked about, well, the other thing that we've seen is that just high levels, very high levels of fungal count in cannabis, almost regardless of speciation, can also cause actual health issues. And we've had conversations with folks in the public health department here in Colorado. And I think that, you know, this probably applies not just to consumers, where you can actually see it in acute way as actually in employees in the industry, where, you know, and I think it's not just limited to the testing facilities. I'm sure this kind of thing is occurring at cultivation facilities and things like that, where you have people handling product that potentially have high levels of fungal contamination. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like the evilest, most heinousest bugs of all. It just the general load in total can become very dangerous. And so we've kind of got to be mindful of both the really, really heinous stuff, but also the aggregate load level, because there are people throughout the supply chain and consumers and patients that are being exposed to both forms of risk.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, if you have the idea behind it is if you have a really high fungal load, you know, for example, like it's colony forming units is how you're measuring, you know, microbial content, what it is. Something that's, you know, 100,000 colony forming units or CFUs is considered a very high microbial load. You know, so different states have regulations, and this is kind of based on experience within the USDA, you know, looking at what are fungal counts that cause issues. It doesn't mean that if you have something that's at 10 to the fifth, the assumption is that something in there is probably pathogenic, or that the product is so contaminated that it really shouldn't be allowed out there. And so there's, you know, different ways of looking at it. I mean, if you're looking at specific organisms that you know cause problems, that you know are pathogenic, you know, I feel like those should be included in regulations as well. You know, we know that there's tests out there to test for specific Aspergillus species, and there's tests out there to test for total yeast and mold. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. States have kind of, for some reason, made a choice that it's one or the other. And I think that as time goes on, we'll probably see that they're going to pick up both when it comes to fungal load. But we'll see. I think Colorado is starting to shift probably that way to pick up specific organisms as well. And we'll see if other states start to adopt sort of a hybrid approach to that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what we certainly hope and plan to see over the coming years is really development of consistency, development of best practices. And what we're going to talk about is CGMP. And, you know, I think the biggest issue that we've always seen in the cannabis supply chain from a product safety standpoint is that, you know, endpoint testing on its own is kind of an inefficient allocation of resources, right? Like, you can't test everything, because if you test everything, you'd have nothing left to sell. So you're really testing a random selection of samples in a lot of products. And you know, that is one certain way to protect product safety. But what we'll eventually get to is 100% of our efforts are there, as opposed to being spread out throughout the supply chain. So before we get to that, though, I do want to talk about, because there is one thing that I've always kind of thought is kind of almost odd, and I want to work through, is like, well, right now we've only been talking about fungus, right? And raw flour, a lot of other testing programs bring in other things like E. coli and salmonella and other microbiological contaminants, that are, you know, those little other kinds of microorganisms that are not cool. And so, this really stems in a large part. First, we can start talking about edible safety. You know, what are the things we should be looking for in there? Why do we need to look at those things, and how do they get introduced into the products themselves?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, the cannabis industry, you know, as you said, they really test the end product, and what you really want to do is test from cradle to grave. And we can get into like kind of the details with preventive environmental monitoring and how you follow a product from its inception all the way to when it's packaged. But getting back to, you know, looking at other pathogenic organisms like E. coli, Salmonella, Listeria, those are really food safety organisms, right? So, you know, everybody's heard of outbreaks of E. coli or Salmonella in leafy greens or at Jack in the Box or, you know, Chipotle or whatever restaurants have that. When you're, a lot of these edible products, you know, are made in people's kitchens. There isn't a lot of, you know, full, you know, production facilities that are making these edibles right now. It'll get to that point. But you really want to monitor for an outbreak of E. coli and Salmonella. And generally where that comes from is from basically the chef or the cultivator not washing their hands, not keeping a clean facility. So, you know, for example, we were working with a group that was having an E. coli outbreak in their facility. And it's pretty rare to find E. coli and Salmonella on flour. Usually you don't find these bacterial organisms on flour for whatever reason. And most of the time when they're there, it's because of mishandling of the products. You have people trimming the product and they didn't wash their hands or they touched their face or something. When those get onto the product, they have an environment where they're able to grow and really multiply and get to a level that's dangerous and infectious. And so, you know, within the industry, you can have this issue where if you're not testing for a product like that and you have somebody mishandling it and you have this outbreak of E. coli and Salmonella on your flour, you have it in your edibles, you know, that makes the news. That's bad for the entire industry. It's bad for everybody. Not only will people get sick, but you're looking at, you know, revenues dropping. You're looking at all the people who are naysayers in the industry saying, look, they don't know what they're doing. And so, you know, an industry like ours, it's important to, you know, stay above board so that, you know, you don't have people out there saying, you know, this is one reason why you shouldn't do this and take away from the benefits of the product.
Yeah. And I, again, there's so much to unpack there. And so I think the first thing that we want to draw out is, you know, and I've had to say this to people in public health departments before, like cannabis isn't a known antiseptic. So the same contaminants that you would find in food products, you would find in edible products. I'd probably quibble with the idea that we're still back in the days of people producing in their kitchen. I see some of the fanciest stuff out there in terms of manufacturing, but you know, it's like any other manufactured consumable product. There is potential introduction for contamination in the production process. And that comes frequently from handling things. And so that is why, and we can get into endpoint testing later, why we're looking at E. coli, Listeria, Salmonella, that we're testing edible products for a lot of those things. And I think that's a pretty linear thought process for folks. And I think we see that not only consistency in the regulatory structure, but kind of consistent support for that kind of endpoint testing. The other thing that we see, and we see frequently though, is like we also are testing flour for those exact same kinds of contaminants. And as you noted, it is very unlikely that E. coli, Salmonella, or Listeria will be found kind of naturally on a growing cannabis plant. While we might find Aspergillus there, we are unlikely to find these other, you know, kind of E. coli, Listeria, Salmonella. But what ends up happening is through the handling of the product, they are on there. And so we're testing the flour for these contaminants, not because it's naturally found in the growing environment, but because at some point a human being is going to have to cut that plant out of the ground. They're going to have to handle it as it's dried and cured. They're going to have to break it off, trim it, and do all of those things to make sure that that product is then packaged and ready for sale. And throughout those processes, there is significant potential for the introduction of contaminants, just as there would be in the production of an edible. It's the exact same thing. It's not the growing medium that we're worried about. It is actually the handling of humans and where they can introduce contamination. And so it's so important because I think, as you noted, you know, this is a critical component of our industry, and it is not good for anybody when there are recalls, when there are product safety issues. We all look bad at once. And I think that it's very important to understand that these things have major, major impacts on different people's businesses over time. Okay. So I think that the next thing that we want to talk to is all of this stuff is endpoint testing, right? And that's one of my favorite things to kind of talk about. I think in the big picture is there are no other consumable products that I'm aware of anywhere in any FDA approved regime that has a product safety mechanism largely or exclusively based on endpoint testing, right? We see some regulations on using stainless steel surfaces and food safe surfaces in most states. But really at the end of the day, there is going to be a test that is almost 100% of our resources are put into this one test at the completion of the product. And we are going to say, okay, this is good or not good based on that sole endpoint test. How does that differ from literally the entire non-cannabis universe?
Yeah. So yeah, cannabis is one of the rare industries that really tests the end product in its entirety. And it's kind of doing a disservice actually to everybody, you know, growing it or making the products, because you want to identify a problem before it gets to the endpoint. When it gets to the endpoint, you've lost a lot of money at that point. You know, your product needs to be remediated or it needs to be destroyed. So one thing that we do at Pathogen DX is we have a number of different what we call preventative environmental monitoring tests. So these are broader tests that you can swab a surface. So you can swab your stainless steel table, you can swab your conveyor belt, you can test your water supply, you can test your soil, you can test your air quality. And it allows you to identify pathogens before they get into your product. So for example, you're doing an indoor grow and you're in between grows, you take everything out, you clean it with bleach or whatever you're cleaning your products with. At the end of that, you want to swab. You want to swab your drains. You want to swab your lights. You want to identify every potential area where organisms can get into, all the way from the cultivation stage through the processing stage. And you want to do that regularly so that you can identify any organisms that might be harboring there that you wouldn't think about. And this is something that's commonly done in the food industry, where they're testing everything from cradle to grave. When a product comes in, before it's shipped out, it's being tested. They're testing seeds, they're testing soil, and it's all for being able to catch something before it gets into the consumer's hands. And as I said, it seems like a process that you're going to, you know, lose money on. That as somebody producing it, they might say, well, I'm not required to do this testing. Why should I do this testing? And then when they have a batch of product fail, and maybe that's their only grow that year for some of these small growers, you know, that could be your entire revenue for that year that you've lost when you're doing that. And if you were to just spend a little bit of extra money and time making sure that your facility is as clean as possible, being able to catch these bugs before they get in there, then you're going to end up having assurances before you take it to the final stage, which is getting your product tested, that you're going to pass that product. This is something they've incorporated in the food industry through the Food Safety Modernization Act. And it's something that's required for food safety distributors and food safety producers. And most of these food producers do it on their own, you know? And it's because, as we talked about a few times, when you have something that's a contaminating event that makes the news, that can shut your company down. And not only can it shut you down, it can mean that maybe if you come back next time, people don't want to buy from you because they don't trust your product. And there's been instances like that in Arizona where there's, you know, a grower where it's known that they have Aspergillus issues and they keep failing. So, you know, these things make it around. It's a small community. It's not that big of a community here. And, you know, programs like preventive environmental monitoring, where you're swabbing, taking water quality tests, and looking for all sorts of organisms in there, is only going to make you more confident about your product. And it's also going to boost the industry because it's going to show people, you know, look at all the safeguards we have in place. Look at what we're trying to do to ensure that this product is as safe as possible when getting to the consumer. Nothing's 100%, you know, things slip by and it's just how it is. But, you know, doing these things can help prevent a lot of outbreaks and can really help your business grow.
And I guess, you know, would it be normal in a general food production standard under like a FSMA situation where literally every lot of product X that comes off the line gets tested for a series and battery of contaminants?
Yeah, it depends what product you're looking at. But like, you know, for example, if you have a production line, there's what's called zonal swabbing. And it's something that probably should be incorporated into a lot of edible food production as well. But zone one would be anything that touches your product specifically. So maybe it's the conveyor belt that is, you know, bringing your product along, or your baking sheet or something like that. And then it just keeps moving further and further away to zone two, zone three. Zone four might be like somebody's locker room or the door handle on the outside. And, you know, it's really just designed to catch any of these contaminants before they get into the food production line. And microorganisms are really great at hiding out in the most unlikely places, in little cracks in your instrumentation, like I said, in drains, along the conveyor belt. And they can really create like these biofilms that are kind of resistant to cleaning products. So it's one, to make sure that you don't have harborage organisms, but two, to make sure that your cleaning procedures are working the way they're supposed to. Microorganisms are very good at mutating. As we've seen with the COVID outbreak, you know, it's a good example of a virus that's mutated. Microorganisms behave the same way. They come up against something that's a stressor, like some type of cleaning product. If they see the cleaning product over and over and over again, and you have some organism that has been exposed to it and survives, it's most likely mutated. And when you start to see these mutated organisms, it can create some serious issues in the environment. You know, so we're all familiar, like I said, with COVID. You're also familiar with hospital-acquired infections. Those are tend to be microorganisms that have seen different amounts of antibiotics and are resistant to them. And we all know, you know, when you get to that point, it's hard to remediate something at that point.
Yeah, and so really what I think you're trying to drive home is that when you look at the supply chain, right, and that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about from the moment, you know, as I say, we're an edibles manufacturer, from the moment flour is received or oil is received through the entire production process of extraction, infusion, manufacturing of that ingredient through the end point, that in the non-marijuana land and in kind of other consumable product production lands, we're really trying to test throughout the entire supply chain. And that is kind of an ongoing testing process. And what we don't typically see is government mandated third party laboratory testing at the end point of products, right? Like that sometimes it's in-house testing, sometimes it's out-of-house testing, depending on the products and the standard operating procedures and risks associated. You may not be testing every batch. You may be testing every third batch, every fifth batch, because the safety regime that you're going to employ is dictated by your manufacturing process based on the risks that are proposed. So the first thing you would do is a risk analysis. You would identify where the risks in your point of production are, and then you would build a customized plan to address those risks. In the cannabis industry, we don't do that. We have a one-size-fits-all policy approach where we test in almost every state, every single lot, individually and separately, by a third party that the government mandates on a consistent schedule, even capping batch sizes. And what that does is it puts all our eggs in one basket, right? And that's really, I think, the concern that I've always had since I literally created a system like this 8 years ago, is that you know, as I've learned more, what I've learned is we're putting all our eggs in one basket. And that's usually not when you're looking at risk, right? You don't put all your eggs in one basket. If it, product safety testing at its core is risk mitigation, right? And if you're going to try to mitigate risk, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. What you want to do is spread that investment out across the supply chain. And that's, I think, when we look at kind of what are the lessons from FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, that's really in a lot of ways what it's saying is, hey, you got to look at your risks from the very, very beginning all the way to the very, very end. And then you're going to design a customized approach to address those concerns instead of the government saying, hey, every single batch has to be tested for this battery of contaminants. It needs to be sampled like this. And that's it. And what we're not doing and what we're saying to our cannabis producers is you have to invest significant money in this one specific point in the process, no matter what. And what that's doing is taking resources. It's sucking all the oxygen out of the room, all the water out of the pool, instead of spreading it out throughout the whole supply chain, right? And what we want to see as we move into the next, you know, the Cannabis Safety Modernization Act, maybe that will be a thing one day, is that we will spread that investment out. This is, I want producers and listeners to understand that this is not necessarily a call for more or less testing. It is a call for risk-based product safety investments that are spread throughout the supply chain. It could lead to more testing on some products. It could lead to less testing of other products, but it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. That is not best practices. And in fact, what we want to be doing is testing your inputs, testing your soils, testing all the different pesticides and contaminants that you're, nutrients that you're using for contaminants. Then you want to be testing your surfaces, your ducts, your air quality, all of those things. And by actually spreading out throughout the entire supply chain, the same amount of investment, right? We're not talking about more or less. Let's say it's actually constant. If you spend $1 million a year on testing, we're not saying you should spend 2 million or half a million. We're saying spread it out throughout the supply chain. And then if you do that, you will have a much safer product.
Exactly. I mean, so, and you're right. It's not a one size fits all. Different products are going to require different testing. Flower is going to require different testing than a tincture, than an edible, because they go through different processes. In food testing, you know, doesn't have the same, every product doesn't require the same testing as well. It depends if that product has a kill step, and they have different safety limits for different products. So a fresh product has different safety limits than a canned product or a frozen product, because those canned products go through a kill step. So nothing should be there. A fresh product, you might expect something there. You might have different limits for different organisms. And it's the same way. And kind of a real life example, taking it back to that is a high risk food product is chicken. Chicken is, you are going to find salmonella if you go to a poultry farm. They know that, it's going to be there. There's nothing you can do about it. For that place, let's take one facility. When we're working with a poultry facility, they create what's called a biomap. And so they're looking at their entire facility. They're looking at their supply chain from the farm all the way to the slaughterhouse and the risks that go along that entire process. And they're creating a biomap. And oftentimes you're getting up to 250 different samples from one facility to try to mitigate that risk depending on what's coming through. And so say you have a chicken coming in, it might be dunked. You're going to test for salmonella in that process. It goes through other, you know, slaughtering and quartering processes, whatever they do there. At a certain point, you're going to be testing for salmonella throughout the entire process. And you're going to know at one point, if it's below a certain level, then the rest of the product's going to be safe. But if you test at that point and you find something's higher, then you realize there's a problem upstream. So you can catch that before it goes out to the consumer. But most importantly, you know, you can stop consumers from getting sick, but also you can prevent a huge outbreak and a huge, you know, PR nightmare for your company. And you can go back and find where's the problem and where can I remediate? And that's something the cannabis industry hasn't really quite adopted yet. And maybe it's because there hasn't been, you know, a serious outbreak, a serious issue that's kind of forced the hand. But you want to get to that point before the government intervenes. Because when you have an outbreak like that and the government starts to intervene, people are going to be much less happy with that than us showing them, hey, look, we have all these safety records. we've been doing this proactively. We've been trying to keep on top of things and something slipped. That's a much better situation to be in than to have a product that you say, well, I don't have any safety records. I've never tested anything. I only test the final product. You know, cannabis is probably the only industry that doesn't test from cradle to grave. And, you know, cannabis fits into two different categories. Do you want it to be a drug? Do you want it to be treated like an FDA approved, you know, drug product? Do you want it to be treated like a food product? It kind of fits into both categories. And so it's going to be interesting to see, and you know better than me, you know, where the federal government lands on this down the road and how it's going to be regulated, you know, in that kind of sense.
Yeah, I love the chicken example because chickens are also cooked, right? So it gives us like a whole nother layer, right? And so it is not just, I you know, we've been talking about this as the risk of consumption. The other filter that it's put through is it pasteurized? Is it a kill step? Is it safe? How is the packaging handled after the kill step? And then is it cooked or not, right? So you're going to look at a vegetable from a contamination standpoint very differently than you might look at raw chicken because, you know, we know we're going to cook raw. I assume people cook raw chicken. I guess in theory you could eat it raw. It doesn't sound very appealing to me, but that's kind of an important point here. And like what we're doing is we're customizing what we're doing and taking the same investment in safety and spreading it out through the supply chain. I think you look at this and you apply it to the cannabis industry, right? Are you selling a raw flower product? How are you packaging that raw flower product? Are you using a kill step? Are you making an oil? Well, I would think the product safety regime for rosin versus a hydrocarbon extraction versus even old school bubble hash, like all of those, they're treated in every state that I can think of, they're treated regulatorily as exactly the same product. But I would think a food safety scientist would probably tell you, well, actually, you know, in the rosin, your concern is really this. And in bubble hash, oh, well, that's kind of, that's some weird old school hippie shit. You know, your concerns are this. And then the hydrocarbon is something else. And so, you know, that's really what the Food Safety Modernization Act, and, you know, I mean, we're like boiling stuff down to the most basic components. There's a lot to it, but like, that's really what it is you look at those risks and you figure it out. And I think the biggest problem the cannabis industry has, I think there is absolutely an issue with this, but the government is saying, you have to look here. This is the place to look. This is where you have to focus all your energy. And in competitive markets, if 100% of your resources are being allocated to this one point in the supply chain, then you don't have money is not infinite. It is a finite commodity that all of these businesses have to deal with. And so if they're saying, well, all the money I have to put into product safety to stay competitive is in this one spot, I can't test this and I can't test this and I can't test this and I can't afford a decontamination equipment or this other thing throughout the process. And what we really need to do is figure out where that tolerance, like how much investment is reasonable? What is the percentage of product cost that can go into safety? What is the right number? And make sure that we tailor the regulations in a way that allow people to make those investments throughout the supply chain and start thinking about this as in a much more holistic way. And that's, you know, conversations that have been going on in Colorado that I've been instigating for a long time, for a couple of years now, and I think are starting to take hold in hopefully various places around the country, because what we're seeing is it's just an inefficient allocation of resources, right? It's over testing in one part of the supply chain and not enough testing throughout the supply chain, not enough consideration of kill steps. You know, people, it's very uncommon that people, you know, consume unpasteurized milk. The stories about like the way they handle beef and other kinds of meat from an irradiation perspective, I don't know if people realize it, but most of the beef that's sold in America has been irradiated. And other things have been done to it. Those are preventative kill steps that we don't even think about that have been hard to gain traction in the cannabis space again and again, because all our eggs are in this one basket. And so, you know, I think that sometimes it can become almost out as judgmental against the industry. Oh, you're not doing enough. You're not doing enough. And I think that that's almost an unfair judgment because they're not the ones that decided 100% endpoint testing. You know, they're reacting to the market and the conditions that are set out to them. And what the industry needs to do and what scientists and experts need to do is work with regulators, work with policymakers to help them understand, how do we safely redistribute this investment across the entire supply chain? And there may be certain products that actually see a reduction in product safety costs because the risk analysis determines that product is not as risky. But then there are going to be other products that are going to maybe see an increase. But the spreading out is how we're going to get to this safety area, to this more, I guess, the safety area, the more safe product that we're trying to eventually achieve in the industry.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, there's so many different regulations from state to state. Just bringing one state up as an example that I think has done a good job separating products is Oklahoma. They actually have regulations, you know, it's endpoint testing still, but they actually have different regulations for the different products that are out there. It's not a broad brush that covers everything, but they have, you know, different organisms and different safety levels for, say, lotions, or even suppositories or inhalers compared to flour and oils. And so, you know, it's a start, and they mainly follow USP guidance for that kind of testing. But, you know, it's really state by state, which makes it challenging for a test maker like me to keep up with the different regulations because it's not uniform. But you start to see that now that cannabis has become, you know, much more accepted, you're starting to see more people come out, you know, that have experience in food safety testing or cosmetic testing or drug safety testing, and get involved in the industry and bring their experience into the industry and start to say, hey guys, like, you know, this is the right way to do things. And, you know, we want to be a regulated industry. You want to have those credentials behind you. It makes it safer for everybody. It brings a lot of trust into the industry, you know, and just makes for something like cannabis, it's kind of been controversial, I guess is the easiest word, for, you know, for everybody to be accepted and approved.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe a great point as we start to wrap up is when we think about the cannabis industry today and historically, we've thought about flower, then there were different types of hash. And now we've seen, you know, kind of that included in vape pens. And we've got to think about, you know, we passed regulations around vapor testing, but we also want to think about actually testing the oil over time and see if metals leach and then see if those metals get into the vapor. We're talking about various risk points and considering everything along the supply chain, not just testing the raw oil before it ends up in a vape cart. Then we get into edibles and we talk about testing along the supply chain and the production process. And then I think you touched on something that we have classified as alternative use products here in Colorado. I think we kind of freaked out some of the regulators when they actually figured out some of the things that we were making. But we're looking at nasal sprays and we're talking about inhalers and we're talking about various types of suppositories that fall into that classification. And the inhaler is a very, very different, even though it's an inhalant, it's a very different product safety profile and regime that needs to be put over that vis-a-vis a vaporizer or flower. You know, if you're going to squirt something up your nose, that's a heck of a lot different than putting it in your mouth and eating it, because your stomach is a vat of acid that kills lots of stuff and your nose and your brain that's right there is not. And then you get into, you know, suppositories and things like that. And I think, you know, there was a lot of concern. And in fact, we even saw in an early bill of a anti-cannabis bill that we're still dealing with here in Colorado. They wanted to ban suppositories because these moms think that kids are going to use suppositories to get high in high school. I think that's probably unlikely and they'll just eat an edible. They shouldn't be doing that at all. But the reality is, like, you know, suppositories, and I think we've got that resolved pretty quickly, are literally used by the sickest of cannabis patients. They're not for teenagers to kind of goof off with. But there's so much concern about these areas of products, and some of the concern is legitimate and some is illegitimate, and they end up getting souped together and we start seeing product bans and these kinds of things not be available. But what we've seen is that, like, for a Crohn's patient or someone like that, a suppository may be the absolute most effective form of cannabis for really sick people. And so, it's really important that those products are done safely and that we can actually separate legitimate concerns about, hey, look, if you're going to essentially consume a cannabis product through a suppository, like, we need to be way more concerned about microbial contamination than an edible, because you're not going to eat it. It doesn't go through that vat of stomach acid. And then we need to kind of ignore the concerns of kind of, you know, some of the ridiculous stuff to make sure that we can protect those products, but that they're done in a safe manner. And that really is at the core of everything that this entire conversation is about, which is, you know, understanding risk, which is what we started with, right? What are the bugs? What are the things we're testing for? Why are they important? What are the risks that come from them? And then the other part of this conversation that we've really gotten into is like, okay, well, where do we go from here? And I think it is really the phase of the industry where we start to understand, evaluate risk, and customize product safety programs for the risks associated with that specific type of product being produced, and move away from this all our eggs in one basket endpoint testing program for, you know, massive broad classifications of products that are probably produced, you know, as I can't think of anything more different than rosin and a hydrocarbon extraction in terms of like activity, but we're regulating them as if they're exactly the same from a product safety perspective.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, you think about lotions, CBD lotions, there's no reason to test for E. coli or Aspergillus in that, you know, it's going on your skin. You want to test for things that might contaminate your skin. Staph aureus and Pseudomonas and things like that. And so it's really this broad brush that we've painted with as we started up the cannabis industry was a great start. But now that we're further along and we're starting to get into more regulated area, more states are coming on board, the federal government's coming on board as they start to get standards out there to qualify tests, you know, you really want to take a fine brush to every single product out there and make regulations that make sense, you know, for every product that's out there, similar as they've done in every other industry, you know?
Yeah, hear. I mean, I think that's exactly it is, you know, we're not looking for special treatment. We just want the same best practices that we use everywhere else on our industry. And we're working to get there. And, you know, it's great to have folks like you join the cannabis industry 2.5 years ago, because, you know, I remember when I had to write all these testing regulations at the Marijuana Enforcement Division, and I didn't know anything about any of this stuff, but just figured it out the best I could. And we had some good stakeholders that helped us, and we worked really collaboratively to build the testing program, and we've worked in the years since. But one of the things we have seen is that more and more minds coming into the industry have going to yield to better policy. They're going to yield to better results. So it's been awesome getting to learn from you. I think I've learned quite a bit actually just recording this podcast with you over the last little while, and look forward to really continuing to work together with yourself as well as other folks to make great policy. So I guess just one other thing before we wrap up, if anybody wants to follow up with you, talk to you, track you down, learn about Pathogen DX, how can we find you? How are you findable? What's your website or your whatever you want to share with folks?
Yeah. So, if anybody wants to learn more about the company, you know, Pathogen DX, pathogendx.com. We have a new revamped website that's pretty nice. And we've had a lot of nice publicity recently around our COVID testing. So, you know, in the healthcare industry, kind of outside of this. If people want to find me, I'm on LinkedIn, Benjamin Catchman. I don't think there's another Benjamin Catchman out there, but you can, if somebody else is out there, you can let me know.
I found you by Googling Benjamin Catchman Pathogen DX, and I found you pretty quick. So you are Googleable, my friend, one way or another.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast today. We really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us, and we look forward to, you know, working together with all the other stakeholders to make the cannabis industry stronger and better public policy. I guess it's Friday here, so I'll just say happy Friday to you, and I guess it's probably going to be Monday or Tuesday to the listeners when they hear this, but at least Ben and I will have a nice weekend, and then you guys will have a nice week next week. So with that, we will just say stay nerdy, everybody. All right, Shay, make the magic.